10.
Terrible Tommy knows, and we're here at the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Well, let's start off with the funny part of the show. How about it? You want to hear something funny? This is hilarious. Get ready to roll in the aisles over this one.
Speaking of holes of the buttocks, the U.S. Army has admitted they fudged their books to the tune of millions of dollars in 2015. I'm sorry, that billions of dollars they lied. Oh, I'm sorry, trillions of fucking dollars they lied about. The Defense Department's Inspector General in a June report said the Army made $2.8 trillion in wrongful adjustments to accounting entries in one quarter alone in 2015 and $6.5 trillion for the year. And the Army did not have receipts or invoices for those numbers. They just made up what they did with the money. Do you realize how much money that is? Here's an example of how much money that is. The right wing loves to say Social Security is bankrupt, right? It's we gotta get rid of it or change it's bankrupt. Well, first of all, that's pure crap. But secondly, even by the right wing Heritage Foundation's right wing magical numbers, Social Security ran a $39 billion deficit in 2014. That's what the right wing is losing their mind about. And yet our military had $6.5 trillion in unaccounted for adjustments. Covering Social Security's budget deficit would be a rounding error for them. You know, maybe we could get the Army to pay for Social Security if we just called it something more warlike. You know, like strategic defensive strikes against old people. Like you just hurl money at them out of a t-shirt cannon. It keeps them home. It keeps them away from us. You know, it's old people defense. There, done. Now we can get the money out of the trillions in defense spending. You're welcome.
Hey there.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, the Army just got allocated $700 or $800 billion for more weapons. I don't know whether to cry. I think I'll shut down the show and cry the rest of the day. But don't make any difference. It just figures on paper anyhow. It's all credit. It comes out of the sky. Just like spooks in the sky. Yeah, $1 trillion worth of credit. Not one solid quarter or 50-cent piece among them. And you thought you had a wonderful self-defensive military system in this country to protect you from everything except them. And you keep track of it now for the next few months and see if anybody goes to jail or anybody even loses their eagles on their shoulders or their stars or anything like that. Nobody. The bigger amount you steal, the less time you do. If you steal enough, you never do time. Do you realize the average Muslim woman in this world is turning out 5 babies at least? And in Europe, it's 1.5 white people, 1.5 babies. And the United States is 2.1 babies. So you've already lost the war. I mean, come on. And what about Mother Teresa becoming a saint? Oh, man, I'll tell you. And Mother Teresa now is being attacked by the left wing viciously because she was fighting against abortion in the pest holes of Asia. If there ever was a place that needed abortion on demand, or even forced abortion, it's in India over there where she was hanging out. So at least the left wing's right about one thing. The trouble is they're all for abortion here in the United States, especially of white people. if they concentrated on blacks and mestizos, that'd be fine. In fact, like I said before, I want to buy stock in abortion mills in the black and Mexican mestizo areas of the country. But I don't have that kind of money, boys and girls. But if you got money, maybe you should have done it 20 years ago. Yeah. Well, I see that they say ISIS has directed its lone wolves to strike Australia. Quote, stab them, shoot them, poison them, run them down with their vehicles, comes the latest missive from ISIS. All they have to do is say something on the internet and the world goes crazy. That's the power of the lone wolf. All they have to put a pronouncement, we're going to attack Australia. The whole country? You don't have enough guys to have a gathering in a telephone booth. But it works. It works wonderful. And the media love it because the media is making lots of money. And the police departments in Australia are making lots of money. Everybody's making the money. Well, I see Phyllis Schlafly. They say anti-feminist. I don't think she was anti-feminist. She surely wasn't anti-woman. I knew her from way, way, way back in the 60s. She's died at 92. She was a big religious right-winger, but she had a lot of good issues, too. And at least she was a woman out there fighting. Okay, that's too bad. She was 92 years old. One of the old line conservatives. If religion wasn't so dangerous, it would be funny because they do so many funny things and they flip-flop all the time. This is from Bordeaux, France. Tarek Albrow is the leader of the Muslim community in the city famous for earthy red wines that have made this region a household name, and that his followers are forbidden from sampling. But after three major terrorist attacks in 2 years and recent controversy over the burkini swimsuit, Albrow has become France's leading advocate for an Islam that's progressive, inclusive, and most of all, French. In a series of articles, television interviews, and now a popular book, Albrow has publicly criticized the headscarf, argued for welcoming homosexual Muslims into the faith, and equated the essence of Islam with the basic French idea of human emancipation. These guys, priests and imams and all these people, for this imam, the two are one and the same and entirely unrelated to the frequent public debate over what Muslim women wear, either on the street or on the beach. Well, if I was in France, I'd pass the law, they got to go naked or they got to go home. I don't care what people put on their heads, he said during an interview in his office in Bordeaux's Grand Mosque. The room was piled with books from the floor to the ceiling. And, of course, most of it is a bunch of bullshit. I find that a shameful debate. I think it's funny to watch these Islamic women covered from head to toe in the water. I wonder how many have drowned so far. In his recent book, What You Don't Know About Islam, published in February, Albrow calls for an Islam of France, which he defines as a reconciliation of a spiritual Islam that expresses itself in the language of the republican values already in place, namely France's holy triumphant of liberty, equality, fraternity. And that got us in quite a bit of trouble before. I remember a National Socialist out in California who used to hang out in San Francisco. I forget his name now. He went bananas and became Islamic, yeah, and a couple of guys had been over to his apartment in the old days, and he had his prayer rug out there praying three times a day. Then he moved up into the hills of Northern California and started a little reclusive group, and several people went there and joined up with him, and I think his name was Turner, but I'm not sure. He died a few years ago. But he never brought the Islamic idea to the National Socialists very well. They just weren't buying that shit. Religion's funny. Christianity did the same thing as the Islamics do now. They did it back in the day when the pagans were powerful. They come at you with one hand with a soft hand of peace, and the other hand with a sword and chop your head off. They used both methods. It's worked for every religion that's been created on earth. And then, too, I guess if the Church of the Creator is going to get any place, they got to have the pretty please on the one hand and chop their head off with the other. I guess some of them have tried it. Yeah. Well, that great white hope, Donald Flip-Flop Trump, the Republican presidential candidate, stepped up his bid to win over nigger votes by addressing a largely nigger church in largely nigger Detroit on Saturday and calling for a new civil rights agenda to support nigger Americans. You see, he's going to outdo the Democrats. As scores of protesters outside chanted, "No justice, no peace," Trump said he wanted to make Detroit a predominantly nigger American city, which recently emerged from bankruptcy. The economic envy of the world by bringing black companies from abroad. Huh, that's interesting. Going to make it a big black futuristic city. Well, yeah, if he piles them all in there and keeps them in there and builds that wall around Detroit instead of, well, we can have two walls, one around Detroit and one across the border. Trump separately met with about 100 community and church Negro leaders. His campaign said in his latest push to peel away nigger voters from Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. And that's all this is about. It's all it's ever about. The Republicans use the same method on the Southern strategy under the Republicans and Nixon and those people. All he wanted to do is break the back of white racism in the Democrat Party, which was pretty damn strong. So they wooed him away, the whites, into the Republican Party by out-racist the Democrats. They didn't give a shit about the white race except their own wealthy small percentage of billionaire, trillionaire type whites. They didn't care about the working class. They just wanted to get their votes, and then they do whatever they want, which they did. So there's nothing new to this kind of stuff. The political parties have done it over and over again. That's because the political parties are corrupt. And Washington General George warned us we shouldn't have political parties. We didn't need political parties. You could run things by plebiscite. And now, hell, you could put a box on the side of your TV with buttons on it, and every major question that comes up about running a government, yes, no, maybe. Go to war, yes, no, maybe. But they'll never do that because this is not a democracy. It never has been a democracy, and it never will be a democracy. I wonder how David Duke and those people and the Klan are fixing their, changing their way of thinking to stick with old Donald. There's no reason in the world to stick with Trump. besides being a billionaire, nobody could trust a billionaire. A billionaire like Ross Perot used to say, "I feel your pain." Bullshit. You had he had several billion dollars. He doesn't feel your pain or my pain or anybody else's pain. So let's just forget about all this silly voting for these guys. If you're going to fight for the white race, make it real, brother. Take it to the streets or take it to the top of the trees and so forth. Trump says, "I fully understand the African-American nigger community is suffering from discrimination. They always have suffered. And that there are many wrongs the white people are doing to blacks that have to be made right." Trump said at the church, which was half full, quote, "I want to make America prosperous for everybody. I want every little nigger be driving a Cadillac or Lincoln. I want to make this city the economic envy of the world. And we niggers can do that." Oh, guys. Of course, you know, no Negro ever invented a car. No Negro ever invented an airplane. No Negro ever invented a big screen TV. And on it goes. So how are they going to make Detroit this great and wonderful colossus city? Oh, I know. Just move all the professional sports into Detroit. You know, have about 20 sports arenas, you know. Football, basketball, all nigger ball. Now, they might be able to get Detroit going that way. But, well, I see the First Church of England's bishop has come out as being a homosexual. I'm shocked. Next week he'll be come out as a pedophile. I want to tell you about a movie that is really good. I never heard of it before. It's called Hard Candy. It's about pedophilia and getting even and all that kind of stuff. This is a real... I'm telling you, you got to see it. It's called Hard Candy. And women are fighting to become priests. They see hope in the Pope's openness to deacons, which won't change anything. Won't change a damn thing. I don't see any reason not to make them priests. If the men can tell bullshit and mythology and so forth, why can't the women tell lies and mythology? I see the Jews, the Jewish women, or a sect of Jewish women, are all upset because they have not been able to pray at the wall, the Wailing Wall. So I tuned into a radio show going on over there, and there's a woman came on and said if these women want equal rights, then they should do like men. They've got to, these Jewish guys have to have circumcision, so the women got to get circumcised too. And all the things that the men have to do that normally women wouldn't do, they're going to have to do if they want the right to go down there with equality and pray at that Wailing Wall. Well, I was there. It was unbelievable how many people were there, and they're all up there kissing that wall and sticking notes in the cracks. And religious insanity. Religious insanity. Like I say, the main thing I don't like Jews for, or at least the leadership of the Jews, they gave us Christianity. That is a real reason to hate Jews, or hate the leaders of the Jews, for foisting on us Christianity. Well, let's see what the crazy Mormons are doing. If you're an LDS seminary teacher, it's been a strange couple of days. On Thursday, you woke up to a world in which the prophets and revelation lesson of the seminary curriculum was fairly predictable. Somewhat disturbing, sure, but predictable. disturbing because it contained a few questionable elements. A section in which the students are taught that as the chief cornerstone, Jesus Christ continues to lead and direct his church through his prophets and apostles. Never directly. You got to have front men. He reveals laws for all God's children and guides his church through these ordained servants. God's laws include doctrine, principles, commandments, ordinances, and covenants, as well as church policies and practices he reveals through his prophets. They have the power, baby. Don't go up against a prophet. He's got a license. It's the as well as church policies and practices phrase that has been a major sticking point as people have complained about the new curriculum over the summer. Namely, that it seems to uphold Mormonism's racial ban on Negro Americans from holding the priesthood and attending the temple as a policy that was personally revealed by Jesus Christ. Well, this statement was followed by an activity in which students were told to sort various examples of eternal laws from church management and policy, which may change, but only by the Lord's prophets as they counsel together and seek guidance from the Lord. So if you don't want niggers in your church, you have to have these special guys that makes that change. They give a whole bunch of stuff. For each item, identify whether it's an example of eternal laws which do not change, or B, laws of priesthood administration and church management which may change. Number one, for all who are accountable, baptism by immersion and confirmation are required to enter God's kingdom. Well, you got to take a bath before you can go to God's kingdom. Under the law of Moses, who was Mises in Babylon, and different names before that, never existed, of course, if you know anything. Only men of the tribe of Levi were ordained to the Aaronic priesthood. In other words, these are make-believe Jews. Before 1896, monthly fast and testimony meetings were held on Thursdays rather than Sundays because the baby Jesus demanded it. From the mid-1800s until 1878, men of the black nigger descent were not ordained in the priesthood. But then God changed his mind. The first presidency of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles reemphasized truth relating to marriage and family when they issued the Family a Proclamation to the World in 1995. In 2012, President Thomas F. Monson announced the minimum age for full-time missionary service would be 18 for young men and 19 for young women. He got that straight from the baby Jesus. 7. In 2015, the first presidency and quorum of the 12 apostles admonished church members to make proper Sabbath day observance a great priority. My question is, why don't they just become Jews and get it over with? They're doing all this Jewish, most of these churches are doing all this Jewish stuff, teaching their kids out of the old Jew Testament and even the new Jew Testament. So why not just become Jews? Well, anyhow, that's it for the Mormons, who the other Christians don't accept because they technically don't believe in the baby Jesus. Well, but there was still one very good change from the original that the Mormons put out, which what was not there was all seven policy or eternal law choices for activity. The part about blacks in the priesthood had been deleted entirely. Wow. Well, I hate to shock anybody, but the statistics, and you can check them out, that a good percentage of the Mormon church now is all black. They've been recruiting in all black Africa for decades, down South America, the mestizos and so forth. So I think only about maybe 20% or less of the Mormon church is white. And that was a church that declared itself to be all white here a few years ago. Oh, yeah, they did let in the Jews. Yeah. Well, hot off the press, let's hear a little bit more about the wonderful Saint Mother Teresa. Yeah.
All over this unhappy globe, there are heroic volunteers putting up a selfless battle on behalf of the wretched of the earth. But only one of these is considered to have invisible means of support, to be nothing less than a saint. What makes Teresa of Calcutta so divine?
An hour before Mother Teresa's helicopter touched down at about 20 past 11 this morning, the crowds were gathering here at Knock.
Among all of you who have made this pilgrimage to Knock, this afternoon, we are privileged to have with us as a special guest at this Mass a pilgrim who has come from afar, a woman whose worldwide symbol for goodness and holiness.
Not many claims made by the Irish clergy are widely or uncritically accepted, even in Ireland. But the saintliness of an Albanian nun named Agnes Boyacu is a proposition that's accepted by many who are not even believers. Mother Teresa herself receives extravagant adulation as no more than her due.
Of all the women in recent history, no one has captured the public imagination like Teresa of Calcutta. I'm not being facetious, and I'm certainly making no comparison when I say that no woman has made such an impact here since Our Lady herself appeared in 1879.
So how did this auction of hyperbole and credulity get started? In that year of grace, 1969, the scrupulously neutral and objective British Broadcasting Corporation permitted that old fraud and mountebank Malcolm Muggeridge to pay a devotional visit to the Calcutta shrine.
I'll just say, when after I met you in London, really the only thing I wanted to do is to come and see you in your work here. Now I've seen it. And of course it's a shining light.
Himself arrogant, almost to the point of humility, Muggeridge became persuaded that he and his team had become the divinely appointed instruments of what he claimed was the first television miracle.
During Something Beautiful for God, there was an episode where we were taken to a building that Mother Teresa called the House of the Dying, and Peter Schaefer, the director, said, it's very dark in here, do you think we can get anything? And we had just taken delivery at the BBC of some new film made by Kodak, which we hadn't had time to test before we left, so I said to Peter, well, let's have a go. So we shot it. And when we got back, several weeks later, a month or two later, we're sitting in the Rushes Theatre in the studios, and eventually up came the shots of the House of the Dying. And it was surprising. You could see every detail. And I said, that's amazing, that's extraordinary. And I was going to go on to say, you know, three cheers for Kodak. I didn't get a chance to say that, though, because Malcolm, sitting in the front row, spun round and said, it's divine light. It's Mother Teresa. You'll find that it's divine light, old boy. And three or four days later, that I was being phoned by journalists from London newspapers who were saying things like, we hear you've just come back from India with Mother Muggeridge, and you were the witness of a miracle.
And a star was born. This profane marriage between tawdry media hype and medieval superstition gave birth to an icon which few have since had the poor taste to question.
It's like
You're actually seeing a living saint.
Give a man a reputation as an early riser, said Mark Twain, and that man can sleep till noon. How does the reputation of Holy Mother Teresa look if, just for a moment, we switch off Malcolm Muggeridge's kindly light?
Mother Teresa is a Nobel Prize winner. She's a symbol. People in the West talk about her. So Indians adopt her at that level. The fact that what she does in the streets of Calcutta is really irrelevant to them. They couldn't care about it. Most of them don't even know. But Mother Teresa is the sort of figure you show to visitors.
Mother Teresa's flagship institution is her home for the dying, a hospice which purportedly sweetens the last moments of otherwise destitute lives.
My initial impression was of all the photographs and footage I've ever seen of Belsen and places like that, because all the patients had shaved heads. There are no chairs anywhere, they're just these stretcher beds, and they're like First World War stretcher beds. There's no garden, no yard even, no nothing. And I thought, what is this? This is two rooms with 50 to 60 men in one, 50 to 60 women in another. They're dying. They're not being given a great deal of medical care. They're not being given painkillers really beyond aspirin and maybe, if you're lucky, some Brufen or something for the sort of pain that goes with terminal cancer and the things that they were dying of. And I thought, what's the point?
Right from the very beginning, I wanted to serve the poor purely for the love of God, and to give them what the rich people get with money. I wanted to give to the poor for the love of God.
They didn't have enough drips. The needles they used and reused over and over and over, and you would see some of the nuns rinsing needles in under the cold water tap. And I asked one of them why she was doing it. And she said, well, to clean it. And I said, yes, but why are you not sterilising it? Why are you not boiling water and sterilising your needles? She says, there's no point. There's no time.
Mother Teresa's cult of death and suffering depends for its effect on the most vulnerable and helpless. Abandoned babies, say, or the terminally ill, who supply the occasions for charity and the raw material for demonstrations of compassion.
The first day I was there, when I finished working in the women's ward, I went and waited on the edge of the men's ward for my boyfriend, who was looking after a boy of 15 who was dying. And an American doctor told me that she had been trying to treat this boy and that he had a really relatively simple kidney complaint that had simply got worse and worse and worse because he hadn't had antibiotics and he actually needed an operation. I don't recall what the problem was, she did tell me. And she was so angry, but also very resigned, which so many people become in that situation. She said, well, they won't take him to hospital. And I said, why? All you have to do is get a cab, take him to the nearest hospital, demand that he has treatment, get him an operation. She said, they don't do it. They won't do it. If they do it for one, they do it for everybody. And I thought, but this kid's 15.
I ventured on my own pilgrimage to the Missionaries of Charity in Calcutta in early 1980. Who could fail to be touched by the work of the orphanage? Not I. Though I did find myself a little put off by the mission's motto, he that loveth correction, loveth knowledge. Bit of a workhouse ring to that, perhaps. But it was Mother Teresa herself who completed the wreckage of the effect. As we stood by the tiny cots, she turned and said, this is how we fight abortion and contraception in Calcutta. Now, it might be argued that a campaign against family planning is low on the list of Calcutta's many pressing needs. But as a leading member of the Pope's fundamentalist tendency on matters of sex and procreation, Mother Teresa has made this single issue into her global crusade.
The greatest destroyer of peace today is the cry of the innocent, unborn child. If a mother can murder her own child in her own womb. What is left for you and for me to kill each other?
Tenderness about the unborn is an emotion that I share myself. But tenderness about the unborn also becomes an overtly political matter when it's preached by a presumable virgin who also campaigns against birth control.
Let us promise Our Lady who loves Ireland so much that we will never allow in this country a single abortion. And no contraceptives.
Mother Teresa has no politics, so she maintains, and so many people believe. But when she came to London in 1988, ostensibly as an advocate for the homeless, she bent the ear of the Iron Lady and sought to steer her to the support of a bill limiting abortion. The sponsors of that bill, who arranged the meeting, were in no doubt that her intervention was political.
She's not a party political figure, but she's a political figure in the sense that, A, she is part of what may be called the Catholic agenda, the Christian, broader Christian right agenda, and the Catholic Church has been following what has generally been considered a hard-line approach under the present Pope. Now, she's part of that agenda, and that is fairly political agenda. I mean, you know, no abortion, opposition to birth control, ideas like that are fairly, you could say they would be contested in the political arena. And the second factor is that she is also part, if you like, of the Western agenda, where the West is still part of the third world.
The rich world has a poor conscience. It wants, in fact it needs, to think that someone, somewhere, is doing something about the third world. And the Mother Teresa myth ministers to this desire.
Here is a Western woman who has forsaken her life, albeit whatever life she might have had in Albania, you know, for sacrifice herself for the people of the third world. It makes the West feel better, you know. This is one of us again, once again rescuing the third world.
He's got his rations.
Yes, he's got his clean
air. In the subliminal appeal that she generates, there is something of the mission to the heathen, something of the old colonial outpost, and something of Florence Nightingale. While in the silent and abject demeanour of her patients, there is something of the deserving poor. The great white hope in this iconography takes on the big black hole. And the rewards are by no means all in heaven. For someone whose kingdom is not of this earth, Mother Teresa has an easy way with thrones, dominions, and powers. Why do the rulers of this sinful and selfish world find her so awfully congenial? Is it because she returns the compliment? She may or may not comfort the afflicted, but she has certainly never been known to afflict the comfortable. Some people see her here, posing with Ron and Nancy.
In the truest sense, citizens of the world, Mother Teresa is.
The very hand that bestowed the Medal of Freedom on Mother Teresa armed and paid the death squads of Central America. Accepting the award with her customary modesty on behalf of all the world's poor, she croaked, "I never realized that you loved the people so tenderly. I must say, I hadn't noticed that either." Reagan's proxies murdered, among many others, four American nuns and the Catholic Archbishop of San Salvador at the very moment that he was celebrating Mass. But, visiting the slaughterhouse states of the region during that period, Mother Teresa found nothing untoward. Everything was peaceful in the parts of the country we visited, she claimed, after touring the killing fields of Guatemala, adding for good measure, "I do not get involved in that sort of politics." In 1984, a ghastly chemical spill from the Union Carbide plant in the Indian town of Bhopal took 2,500 lives and poisoned thousands more. This was an act not of God, but of a negligent multinational corporation. Mother Teresa's advice to the angry victims?
Forgive.
What Mother Teresa has done is she has accepted implicitly the idea that there's nothing much you can do for the poor except take them off the streets and, you know, look after them. You cannot change their attitudes. You cannot make them feel that they have an ability, they may even have the means, to improve and change their lives. She's not bothered with that agenda. She's only bothered with the agenda of trying to rescue their souls and make them a bit better before they go on to the eternal life, which is a very understandable, but in fact a very old-fashioned Christian idea. It is not a question of saying, how can we tackle the real problems of poverty?
Like most people who claim to be apolitical, Mother Teresa is in practice and in theory an ally of the status quo, and when the status quo is threatened, a trusted ally of the conservative forces. This places her in bold contrast to those, even among the religious, who have rejected the fatalistic and submissive conclusions about poverty that are promulgated by Catholic traditionalists like her.
With our hands, with our life, with our love, we ask justice, we ask freedom, and we take justice, because the justice is not like a gift which they give. No, liberty, freedom, they don't give that. We have to take that. And in fact, we go to the streets and we took our liberty, we took our freedom, asking for justice.
The Roman Catholic hierarchy has never forgiven Father Aristide, the legally elected president of Haiti, whom it regards as a base heretic. For his efforts to chase the moneylenders from the temple, he was banished from his order and forbidden to serve Mass. To the very last, the Vatican was the only foreign power to recognize the military junta that misruled Haiti. And the ground for this, too, was prepared by Mother Teresa. In 1980, she visited the island and accepted the Haitian Legion of Honor Award from Baby Doc Duvalier. She found much to praise in his corrupt, dynastic regime, telling astonished reporters that she had, quote, never seen the poor people being so familiar with their head of state as they were with the Duvaliers. It was a beautiful lesson for me, she simpered. I've learned something from it. The Haitian people, indeed, could not wait to get close to the Duvaliers. Who in their turn moved forever to the French Riviera. Mother Teresa admires the strength of the powerful almost as highly as she recommends the resignation of the poor. When she visited her motherland of Albania, she appeared to take seriously St. Paul's notorious assertion that the powers that be are ordained of God. The Albanian authorities had proclaimed the world's first officially atheist state. They had persecuted all forms of worship except that of their leader, Enver Hoxha. No whit abashed, Mother Teresa laid a bouquet on Hoxha's tomb. Not content with honoring a Stalinist murderer and despot, she also bestowed a wreath on the monument of Greater Albania, a cause that was once smiled upon by Pope Pius IX and his friend Benito Mussolini. Albania is, for secular reasons, quite rich in orphans. So there was ample scope for an orphanage specialist to praise the institutions of the regime while keeping silent about its victims. If it sometimes seems that the saint of Calcutta is never actually in Calcutta at all, this may be because she operates more as the roving ambassador of a highly politicized papacy. Vatican foreign policy has taken her from the shores of Lebanon, where the Roman Catholic militia perpetrated the mass murder of the Sabra and Shatila camps, to Nicaragua, where the cardinal was the patron of the Contras, to Armenia, where she helped Mother Church gain foothold in the Soviet Union. In return, the present Pope is known to have placed her on the fast track for canonization. This is the kind of politics in which she does indeed get involved.
Sometimes when I think of Mother, I wonder if I've done just right. Though I'm many miles away, I can almost hear her say, "Where's my wandering boy tonight?"
Robert Maxwell's genius for self-promotion made a nice fit with Mother Teresa's talent for fundraising. It became hard to decide which of the two was using which, or was it both? In the United States, Mother Teresa accepted well over $1 million from Mr. Charles Keating, a right-wing Catholic fundamentalist and anti-pornography crusader, who was also a California savings and loan tycoon. Mr. Keating's problem was that he was using other people's money. He's now behind bars after the greatest scandal in American financial history. But while he was flying high, Mother Teresa flew right along with him. She got the use of his private plane. He got a personalized Mother Teresa crucifix, which he used to store up treasure on earth.
Let's get him out of here.
Why should the missionaries of charity have such a special vocation for work among the rich? And does Mother Teresa pick frauds because they need her help more than the honest billionaires? It's not a question that she's ever answered, but then, in the prevailing atmosphere of piety and adoration, it's not a question that she's ever been asked. The Teresa cult is now a missionary multinational, with annual turnover in the tens of millions. If concentrated in Calcutta, that could certainly support a large hospital, and perhaps even make a noticeable difference. But Mother Teresa has chosen instead to spread her franchise very thinly. To her, the convent and the catechism matter more than the clinic.
Now we are in 105 countries, and we have 500 convents all around the world, without counting India. Beautiful.
Simplicity, humility. By these canonical keywords, we are taught that we may recognize saints. Yet Mother Teresa regards herself as mandated by heaven, which is hardly modest. She lends spiritual solace to dictators and to wealthy exploiters, which is scarcely the essence of simplicity. And she preaches surrender and prostration to the poor, which a truly humble person would barely have the nerve to do. When she speaks about private or public morality, opposing family planning, for example, or defining abortion as quite literally the greatest threat to world peace, she takes on the grim and tedious tones of the zealot and the fanatic. In a godless and cynical age, it may be inevitable that people will seek to praise the self-effacing, the altruistic, and the pure in heart, but only a complete collapse of our critical faculties can explain the illusion that such a person is manifested in the shape of a demagogue, an obscurantist, and a servant of earthly powers.
Well, the Black KKK is going to town, one of their biggest weekends yet, Labor Day weekend. A man was killed and at least 21 more people, including a Chicago police officer, have been wounded in shootings across the city over Labor Day weekend, according to the Chicago police. The latest shootings involved a Chicago police officer who was grazed in the arm in a shooting at 5 a.m. Sunday at the Bridgeport neighborhood. The officer had just completed his shift and was traveling on 31st Street near Loomis when a car pulled alongside and fired at the officer. He was wounded in the arm and taken to Northwestern Memorial Hospital. In Archer Heights neighborhood of the Southwest Side, two KKK black guys aged 22 and 32 were standing in an alley about 12:10 a.m. Sunday in the 4800 block of South Kildare when they heard gunfire and both felt pain. They feel the pain, man. The older man was shot in the head and taken to Mount Sinai Hospital, where he was pronounced dead, police said. The Cook County Medical Examiner's Office did not immediately confirm the fatality. The younger man suffered gunshot wounds to the arm and chest and later showed up at Holy Cross Hospital, where he was listed in serious conditions. In the Irving Park neighborhood of Northwest Side, about 11:50, a 25-year-old woman was outside in the 3400 block of West Irving Park when some black in a black SUV fired at another vehicle and the bullet ricocheted, striking the woman's right leg, police said. She declined medical treatment. 20-minute burst of gunfire Saturday evening left five people wounded in separate attacks. Wow, Black KKK is really going to town. At 8:20 in the Backyards neighborhood on the south side, 63-year-old man was shot in the back by someone who robbed a store in the 1800 block of West 47th Street. At the same time, a 17-year-old boy and a man were shot in the back in the 4900 block of North Kenmore in Uptown. They took themselves to Weiss Memorial Hospital. Just about 8 p.m., a 16-year-old boy was shot in the head in the Austin neighborhood on the west side. Someone walked up to him in a park in the 5000 block of West Hirsch and opened fire, police said. Wow, man. At 8 p.m. in Gage Park, an 18-year-old man was shot in the right leg in 5500 block South Troy, police said. At least 13 more people have been shot in Chicago since 9 p.m. Friday. Last year, 54 people were shot over the Labor Day weekend. Well, boy, I'll tell you, those Black KKK guys are really going strong. This looks interesting. Donald Trump's pitch to the black community of what do you have to lose is not doing much, because they do have something to lose, because the Mexicans are coming in to take their place, or at least they believe they do. If unemployment in some black community is 20%, they could pick up another 20%. If the quality of care at a local hospital stinks, that hospital could vanish, not be there at all, and they'd have no local care at all. If the Black Ku Klux Klan keeps working, I don't know whether that's going to help them out or not. Maybe. If the schools are terrible, at least the schools aren't disappearing. Well, a lot of them in Chicago, they closed up, 100 schools or something last year in Chicago. Any or all of these may happen if a Republican president is elected. It's a silly belief, but it's one the Democrats have done an excellent job of convincing the black community of, the black people in the ghetto. I don't know whether it's much of a community or not, but we'll leave that for them to decide. So if Hillary Clinton is the lying little devil sitting on a cartoon character's shoulder, whiter than white, And while she may have fallen on her head so many times she has to wear a football helmet and a neck brace riding on Air Force One, they're still going to vote for her. And even if they're tempted to vote for Trump over the issue of crime, and I don't see them raising too much hell about crime in their own neighborhoods, they can't see any way in which he can fulfill his promise to stop the shootings in the inner cities. Of course not. He's either a dumb shit or he's lying. The only way you could stop the shootings in the black neighborhoods is to have black cops with a carte blanche to kill. Death squads, so to speak. It wouldn't take long to clean it up, but they'll never let them do that. No, they want the blacks in the situation they're in. The white rich want them, the crooked politicians. They don't want the blacks to decide, hey, let's go along with Metzger, be separate as a race, take care of our own shit, and he'll take care of his. They don't want that. Neither, to be honest, can the white or Hispanic voter. Yet hold on to your hat, because that might, in fact, be the issue that, once it's dragged out of the weeds, might get everybody in the black community, whatever that is, listening, ears on, as we used to say. It could even become even a new signature issue. Trump may ride to victory in November. That'd be a miracle. Much as his determination to build a wall carried him to victory in the primaries. He's not going to build a wall. Nobody's going to build a wall. They've been going to build a wall. Well, they partially built it, but they've been going to build that ever since Simpson-Mazzoli. I was down there at the border when we were arguing about it, and Pat Buchanan was running for president, put out his line of bullshit. I yelled at his people, and they yelled back at me. I said, you Republicans, you're just as bad as the Democrats. You want that cheap labor just like the Democrats. They want to use them for one thing, you want to use them for another. Oh, you're going to ruin Pat Buchanan's chances to be president. I said, that'll be the day when hell freezes over, he'll be president. Because there is a way everybody except the appalled liberals or progressives or whatever that is can see how he can fulfill his promise to stop the shootings. Well, you just shoot the shooters. Declare on his first day in office he'll start a gang war. Us against them, not us. Not use all legal means to disarm and destroy criminal gangs killing people in the inner city. Not jaw about programs to reduce poverty that supposedly encourages criminal behavior. Not bore us with focus group points about how to improve the education of urban youth. And then what? No, probably no jobs. You can be educated all you want, but if there's no job, there's no job. But promise to beat those inner city gangs to a bloody pulp using means that Hillary Clinton, in the absence of some bribe from a lobbyist, wouldn't even consider. There are five major ways in which Trump can batter the thugs, and they're all tried and true. Now, this is not my thinking, even though I might agree with it, coming from somebody else. One, Chicago agreed to a rule for its police that requires officers making a stop to fill out an ACLU-crafted form so their stops can be analyzed. Well, they might need to do that. An officer's discipline for racial profiling. Huh. As a result, police stops have dropped from 100,000 a year to 30. But police have to be able to talk to people freely and follow their nose in these conversations in order to effectively resist street crime. So tear up the ACLU's form and every similar form anywhere in the country. Two, the most successful method of getting guns off the street quickly is stop and frisk, search. The ACLU doesn't like that either, but pass whatever laws you have to implement it everywhere, or, as Rudy Giuliani showed, just do it. Parolees account for an enormous amount of crime in New York and Chicago and elsewhere. Don't come back up with new standards. Don't study the issue. Just stop all parole. Let murderers and thugs serve out their sentences. Donald Trump taking this one position alone will change the conversation. Implement Project Exile, a program in which anybody committing a crime with a gun does an automatic 5 years in federal prison far away from his home turf. This worked before in Northern Virginia and will work again elsewhere. Provide federal snitch money, allowing all police officers with no reference to high authority to pay cash rewards, $100 or $200, to street people who provide information that leads to the seizure of a gun in the hands of a minor or a felon. Yeah, as long as they keep it to minor and felon or felon. And that's that. Just the declaration of a gang war will have Americans everywhere beating their chest. After all, the Texas Rangers are tougher than the Bloods, the U.S. Marshals tougher than the Crips, the NYPD, the Chicago and Dallas, and 1,000 other local departments tougher than the Latin Kings, and certainly tougher, better trained, more dedicated than any drug cartel or single-purpose drive-by thug losing off rounds at random in some crowded neighborhood. Do it, Donald. Carry the election with more black, Hispanic, and white votes than anyone ever thought possible, and save the lives of thousands of innocent children, mothers, and men at the same time. Donald, declare a gang war, or at least that's how a 71-year-old but still very handsome man living on America's oldest main street sees it. That's pretty good. We might disagree a little bit with that. I don't know if this guy was black or white or what, but I like it. Declare gang war. Maybe we should have ran this guy for president. He's got a lot of common sense. But just remember, boys and girls, most people are always wrong when it's most important to be right. Don't forget that. Just because you're outnumbered and they're all saying you're nuts and you know what you're talking about, just remember that. Most people are always wrong when it's most important to be right. And right now, it's very, very important to be right. That's it for today, boys and girls. Yo, Tears Day, off and clear.
Wait. 237 pounds. Fortune, danger. Who is it?
It's not Terrible Tommy because he's slim and trim at 175.